You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to a scientist about a recent study looking at elevated ozone levels in the Sheboygan area.
First, Governor Scott Walker signed the Regulations from the Executive in Need of Scrutiny, or RAINS Act, into law yesterday in Wausau. The measure requires legislative approval for any rule that would cost businesses or taxpayers more than $10 million.
Adam Nealon is the Republican Assembly representative from Pewaukee. He's chair of the Assembly Jobs and Economy Committee and a co-author of the RAINS Act. Representative Nealon, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, this is law now. Spell out for us what changes, what is new in this legislation?
Well, like you mentioned, there would be a new requirement that if a rule that's been proposed has a price tag of over $10 million in compliance costs, then it would need to be approved by the full legislature, yes or no, for that rule to move forward. It also implements a new public hearing in the rule process so that small businesses and different industries are able to meet with an agency that's proposed a new rule before the analysis is rejected. And it would also allow for the legislature to request an independent economic analysis of a new proposed rule, so we're able to have a different perspective from outside of an agency that provides a more complete picture on the economic impact that new rule will have.
And as a co-author of this legislation, why did you see a need for it?
Well, I think in a lot of ways it's preventative in nature. I see the rulemaking process on a daily basis, and I see there are a lot of things that go through the rulemaking process that obviously have the same impact in law, and I don't believe they have the full scrutiny of the public or, quite frankly, the industries that are impacted by these rules because they're done through an administrative rulemaking process that the public doesn't really have as full of grasp on as they do the legislative process. You know, a lot of people participate in public hearings. A lot of people contact their legislators when there are proposed new laws, but there's not that same sort of discourse from the public for new administrative rules. So we thought bringing a little more scrutiny, a little more oversight into the rulemaking process would have a positive impact on the process overall.
Are there regulations, recent regulations from state agencies that you see would have been a good example of why this was needed?
Well, there aren't a whole lot of new rules with a price tag of over $10 million, quite frankly. It doesn't happen often. And the most recent example that I could think of was there was a rule put forward by the Department of Natural Resources in 2010 that had to do with phosphorus and surface waters in Wisconsin. And it far exceeded the federal standard that was implemented from the Clean Water Act. And on top of the federal law, there was billions of dollars in new compliance costs for companies to implement new rules set forth by the DNR. Another thing that I was looking at in my research was the ability potentially down the road to potentially change the renewable portfolio standard. We have set forth a certain amount of electricity burned from utility companies has to be renewable, and we've set that threshold years ago. And without this type of protection, it's very possible that an agency or potentially an executive down the line could attempt to change that renewable portfolio standard without going through the legislature. And I just think if you have a substantial policy proposal, whether it's good or bad or right or wrong, I think it warrants discussion through the legislature. And those are two examples that I can think of.
Talking to State Assembly Representative Adam Nealon from Pewaukee, co-author of the RAINS Act, which changes the way rulemaking works in state agencies, says if there's a price tag to taxpayers or businesses of $10 million or more, the legislature gets to weigh in with a vote on it. Criticism of this, some people are saying, hey, this is actually putting a political spin on what should be left to the experts in a particular agency, the DNR or what have you. Do you worry that this is just allowing too much political influence to go in on what these agencies are there to do?
I think it actually has more of an impact by empowering the public to hold legislators accountable for their actions. You know, the agencies and the scientists and the experts will still be able to weigh in. You know, they'll still be able to submit their rule proposals the same way they were previously. However, if there's a compliance cost over $10 million, it forces action of legislators. And that way, people are able to hold their legislators accountable for their actions. If a state agency, you know, sets forth a policy change that directly impacts people and they believe in a negative way, how does the public then weigh in? How does it hold an agency accountable, or how does it hold somebody in a department that potentially is pushing a political agenda through the rulemaking process? I think it's much easier to hold your legislator accountable. It's much easier for the public then to weigh in and have a say, because ultimately they elect lawmakers to set public policy. And quite frankly, I think legislators and lawmakers should be the one making laws. And I think agencies should be administrating the law, not making new ones.
And another concern is that, you know, maybe there's a new scientific finding that a particular pollutant, say, is causing a lot of damage or health risk. But if I'm in a business that would be affected by a new rule written to restrict that, I can just play a delaying game by saying, this is going to cost me more than $10 million, whether or not the agency agrees with it. I can ask for a second opinion. It's a way of getting around potentially needed regulation.
I think if it's potentially needed regulation, then you will see the legislature act on it. And quite frankly, the agencies are still able to submit these rules, and then the legislature will have to take an up or down vote on that. And a company impacted by a rule will not be able to say, hey, I have a $10 million compliance cost on this, stop the process. It's that determination is made through the agency who is puts together an analysis of how this rule will impact our economy. They currently do that already. They sit down and they try to project what type of impact this will have on the business climate. And if that impact is over $10 million, then there's another path for this rule to have to go through for it to pass. And that's why we thought it was important to provide the option of an independent economic analysis done, requested by the legislature, if the agency potentially comes back with something saying there will be no economic impact, you know, or something glaring that we think is not correct, that there's another option. It's kind of a way to hold them accountable, to make sure that they're putting correct figures forward, because then we have another option of moving forward. So it's not the company, or it's not the impacted industry, that would be able to request this independent economic analysis, and it's not the industry that's going to be able to say, okay, halt the rule because I'll be impacted by more than $10 million. It's going to ultimately be the agency or an independent economic analysis that makes that determination and then provide the legislature an opportunity to weigh in on that rule.
I know this is a brand spanking new piece of legislation. How often do you think it might come into play?
Well, I think the idea of us having to approve rules above $10 million will be rare. I think that is an exception to the rule. Majority of rules, quite frankly, don't have economic impact. A lot of them are, you know, changes to hunting or, you know, fishing issues, or, you know, different things that are not controversial or not expensive in nature. And the $10 million threshold likely won't be utilized often. However, there are other parts of the bill, like having a public hearing earlier in the process so that industries are able to weigh in and let agencies know how a potential rule will impact their agency before that rule is promulgated, that I think may be used quite often, you know, on substantial new rules, large rules. That public hearing aspect, we could see some changes. And I think positive changes within the open, transparent process of rulemaking. However, that $10 million threshold component of the rule, I see is more of a safety valve than something that is going to change the rulemaking process wholesale.
And I want to shift gears before I let you go. You tweeted yesterday that you wished you could have been at the signing of this legislation in Wausau,
right,
but you couldn't. You were in Madison working on the Foxconn incentive bill. What can you tell us about the latest in that process?
Sure. I mean, it's been unprecedented amount of amendments have came through our office over the last week or so since our public hearing. We are weighing through many amendments right now. There's probably 50 or 60 that have been proposed, and a lot of people think I'm being sarcastic, but I am not. I really mean 50 or 60 amendments that have been sent to our office, and we have been working on a bipartisan manner with both Republicans and Democrats on these amendments and local officials, representatives of Foxconn. It's been quite a process, and ultimately I think it's more important that we get it right than get it done fast. So we've had to delay the vote a few times, but you know, in cases like this, I think it's appropriate when you want to make sure you have the best possible product for the people of Wisconsin.
Representative Nealon, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Anytime.
Representative Adam Nealon represents Pewaukee in the state assembly. He's an author of the RAINS Act, which Governor Walker signed into law yesterday in Wausau.
Coming up, we'll learn about a study that tries to make sense of elevated ozone levels in the Sheboygan area. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret.
For the few past years, elevated levels of ozone have been recorded in the Sheboygan area along the Lake Michigan shoreline. Since levels like this are typically found in larger cities, a study was launched to help find out why.
Brad Pierce is a physical scientist for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. He's also at the UW-Madison at the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies. Brad, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Let's start with the problem here. Ozone, we like it up in the atmosphere, not so much closer to the ground. Why is that? Why is it harmful?
That's exactly right. So in the stratosphere, ozone protects us from ultraviolet radiation. Near the surface, ozone is bad to breathe. And so there's quite a few health studies that show that high levels of ozone are both problems for asthmatics, people with heart conditions. And so we're concerned about ambient levels of ozone near the surface.
And as I understand it, we usually think of ozone as a bigger city, major, maybe industrial city problem. It's surprising to find it in a place like Sheboygan.
Yeah, so I think kind of the typical view that people have had in the past is cities like Los Angeles, where they've had ozone problems for 40 or 50 years. Recently, or over the last 20 years, a lot of the emissions have gone down dramatically, significant reductions in ozone pollution as a result of the reduction of those emissions. And so now we have less problems in some of the major urban areas, but that pollution is still transported away from the urban areas. And so we see places like Sheboygan that are now feeling the impacts of that. And actually, they have in the past as well.
What causes ozone at the ground level? What kinds of emissions, what kinds of activities are creating this ozone?
So the ingredients for ozone, you need nitrogen oxides, and you need volatile organic compounds. Both of those come from both cars, particularly the nitrogen oxides, from power plants, and from industry. The volatile organic compounds can also come from biogenic regions, so plants and things.
When we say there are ozone problems in Sheboygan, can you compare the levels we might see there to what we saw in worst cases like Los Angeles at the heyday of
ozone? So again, Los Angeles in the 70s had ozone levels that were up around 200 and above parts per billion, which is four times or so what levels are now. In Sheboygan, in the 80s, there was levels that were certainly high, well above 100 parts per billion. The current regulations for ambient ozone are set at 70 parts per billion, and that's the level that's deemed above that would be unhealthy. So we're still seeing levels that are well above the threshold that can cause health problems.
And is this a case where if we say it's 70 parts per billion, it's like that every day, or are there some peaks and valleys where there's some
Absolutely.
Really worrisome days?
There's peaks and valleys, and in fact, they're very, very sharp peaks. So, for example, during the field study that we had, which started in into May and went through June, we had three significant ozone events. But those three events are important, particularly from a regulatory perspective, because the ozone standards are determined by the highest events during a period.
If I have asthma, for example, I'm worried about those big
Exactly.
things.
Right. And that's why the National Weather Service, which is part of NOAA, and the EPA and the Wisconsin DNR put out ozone advisories on those days where the ozone is high.
Talking to Brad Pierce from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, also with the UW-Madison, looking at an effort to track ozone levels in Sheboygan and to figure out where that ozone is coming from. And that brings us to the research you're doing. Talk us through the kind of things you've been doing on this project.
Okay, so again, ozone isn't emitted. Ozone's formed in the atmosphere. So what we need to understand is what are the various pollutants that lead to ozone production.
Got it.
And so again, what we're looking at are the levels of nitrogen oxides, the levels of volatile organic compounds, and the meteorology that drives the transport from different source regions into the Sheboygan area. We also focused a lot on, there's a number of power plants along the shore of Lake Michigan, and those are certainly contributing to some of those pollution levels as well.
So how do you track where those various ingredients in that stew that makes ozone, how do you start to track where they're coming there from?
So we have a number of different tools that are that are available as we're conducting the field mission. The National Weather Service forecasts ozone and forecasts pollution. So we were using that as guidance. We also had the University of Iowa was running some very high-resolution forecast models that we would use to try and track where the pollution is likely to be going. But the key part of the field campaign was the collection of measurements. So we had a number of different ground stations, two main sites. Sheboygan was one of them. Another one was Zion, Illinois. So these high ozone levels are not just in Sheboygan. They're actually all along the western coast of Lake Michigan, beginning just south of Chicago, or north of Chicago, and then moving all the way up into Door County. So we had measurements along the coast. We had two different aircraft. One was doing remote sensing, so it could kind of map out the pollution over the whole region. Another one was doing measurements from in situ measurements, and we're actually profiling what the concentrations of ozone and nitrogen oxides were.
So you're measuring the levels of not just ozone, but the nitrogen oxide, and you mentioned the volatile organic compounds.
Yes,
are you measuring
right.
those as well?
We are, that's right. So we had researchers, part of the field study was funded by the National Science Foundation, and researchers from the University of Wisconsin Chemistry Department, University of Minnesota, and University of Iowa set up what we're calling a super site at Zion, Illinois, and it measured a full suite of nitrogen compounds and also all these volatile organic compounds. We're still in the process of finalizing that data, so we haven't had a chance to look at it, but we're hoping that that full suite of chemical measurements will help us understand where the ozone's coming from.
How far can these ingredients that help form ozone travel? I mean, how big a target area are we worried about here?
So for this campaign, I do a lot. I've done a lot of field campaigns in the past, both for NASA and for NOAA. And most of my previous field campaigns were looking at much larger scale transport patterns. We can see ozone production from forest fires in Russia that are impacting the western U.S. sometimes. So the transport can be hemispheric kind of scales. What we were looking at for this field study was much more localized. We're looking at a very narrow band where we see enhancements in ozone that's just along the coast of Lake Michigan, and it's associated with the lake breeze circulation that sets up there. And so we're looking at something that could, as I said, we see ozone enhancements that are above where we would anticipate all along the shore, all the way up into Door County. So that kind of, so 300 kilometers or so, but they're in a very narrow band, maybe only 2 or 3 kilometers inland, and that's the key to what we're trying to figure out.
Okay, so I'd imagine this is a lot of stuff coming in from other areas and getting trapped here. Is it maybe that it is a local area, but the conditions around Lake Michigan are taking all the stuff from that area that produces ozone and locking it into this band along the lake? Is that the right way to conceive of it?
Well, so again, we're collecting the measurements to try and understand it. There is certainly theories about why the meteorology over Lake Michigan is unique. And in fact, those theories helped guide the field study. And again, it's this lake breeze circulation. In the springtime, you notice the field campaign was fairly early. It wasn't in the middle of the summer. It started in May. That's when the lake is very cold. And so the sunlight warms the land up, the land heats up, the lake stays cold. You get these very shallow inversion layers. And what we believe is that pollution from Chicago, from Milwaukee, from various power plants along the coast get trapped in that very shallow inversion layer. So what's out over the lake is one of the things we wanted to understand. We had a NOAA research vessel that was equipped with measurements from the EPA that was actually making cruises out over the lake to try and understand what's out in the middle lake when we have these prevailing southerly winds that interact with this lake breeze circulation and lead to these ozone exceedances.
So still a bit of a mystery, and you're still taking, I assume, a lot of data and trying to do stuff with it. What is your hope? Once you've crunched this, can we put this into practice in some way that lowers those ozone levels?
So we won't. What we're doing with measurements will not lead to any lowering of ozone levels. What we're doing with these measurements is to mostly improve our ability to model and to forecast these ozone exceedances. First of all, so that we can improve our awareness and let people know for health concerns. But secondly, these same kind of models, air quality models, are used by the state agencies to design emission control strategies to reduce the ozone. If we can't forecast these exceedances, we can't use the models to design a strategy to reduce emissions. So that's the key use of these measurements. We improve our ability to model ozone along the shore of Lake Michigan.
So very briefly, as we wrap up, what would be the timeline if I'm an asthma sufferer in Sheboygan to know that, hey, I'm going to start getting more reliable ozone predictions?
Well, again, I'm working with the National Weather Service. I've got a team as part of the NASA Health and Air Quality Applied Science team that's going to be trying to take the measurements that we collected in Sheboygan and along the coast and use those in the operational forecast model to improve their emissions. So hopefully you'll see some improvements in the near future.
Brad, thanks a lot for joining us in the studio today.
Well, thank you for having me.
That's Brad Pierce, physical scientist for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. He's working here at UW-Madison, helping solve a mystery of elevated ozone levels in the Sheboygan area and predict them better.
Coming up, our guest tries to get to the bottom of the question, why do women bully each other at work? I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Starting Monday, you'll hear new voices and new perspectives during our evening lineup on the Ideas Network with shows like Newsday, Monday through Thursday at 9 p.m. See the entire schedule and learn about our new programs online at WPR.org.
Now, gender inequality in the workplace is a big issue in the U.S. today. There's still a substantial pay gap between women and men, and men are way more likely to be CEOs at major companies than women are.
One thread we don't hear about often is the controversial finding that people would rather not have a woman boss, especially, here's the kicker, when they're a woman themselves. A 2009 study from the journal Gender and Management showed that women think of other women as good managers, but they still don't want to work for other women.
Our next guest wrote about this issue in The Atlantic in a piece titled, Why Do Women Bully Each Other at Work? We want to hear from you on this at 800-642-1234. Do you see women being extra tough on other women in your workplace? What's your experience been like at work? Why do you think this happens sometimes in workplaces? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Olga Kazan is a staff writer for The Atlantic. Olga, welcome back to Central Time.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
So, Olga, this is a thorny topic, even among some of the researchers that you talked to. It's almost as though you were digging up stuff they didn't exactly want to talk about. Why did you decide to write about this topic?
Yeah, well, so this is just something that has always been there in the gender and sort of management research. That's sort of just an interesting wrinkle. You know, these surveys pick it up that women prefer male bosses, and in some cases, male coworkers also. So it's just sort of an interesting question, and we were kind of wondering, you know, why is that?
And when you brought it up with women in your social circle and you went to some business gatherings of professional women, it was really interesting because at first the women said, no, of course I don't experience this. And then, but there was this one time when, and then it sounded like all these stories started pouring out. What did you hear?
Yeah, so it was interesting where it kind of, people are reluctant to talk about this, I think understandably, and probably for the best. Like, you shouldn't go around kind of perpetuating the stereotype that all women are like this. But, you know, most of the women that I talked to did have sort of one or two stories where they had a really, you know, an experience that was really upsetting. It seemed like their, you know, their manager who was a female or a coworker who was female, let's say she took flex time for herself, but she wouldn't grant them the same, you know, privilege, or they, the female manager would kind of undermine them for a reason that seemed really inexplicable or random. It didn't seem to make a lot of sense. You know, and it's sort of things that, yeah, sure, maybe a male manager had been a jerk to them at one point, but this seemed kind of a little bit more wanton or a little bit harder to understand.
And you open with the story of a woman named Shannon who you said had struggled at an elite law firm. What was her story?
So she really found that, I mean, she had an overall bad experience at the law firm, but she really found that the, you know, there weren't too many female partners, and they just, the women who were female partners weren't liked very much. They, you know, they kind of were seen as either these aggressive, can I say the B word on your program? Probably not, huh?
anyway, that's what she... Let's say no.
That's what she called them. So she kind of broke them down into these different categories, and that some of them were aggressive, some of them were passive aggressive, and some of them were just so overwhelmed by the stress of everything and how much they had to work and take care of their family that they kind of would just neglect their employees and their you know, their employees' needs. So she really had a bad experience with the senior women in her law firm, and she thinks it might have had to do with the kind of overall environment of the firm.
Well, let's get science in on this. There is some research on it that says, you know, maybe this is something that is hardwired, that when women are competing, for example, with mates and resources for offspring, that they're going to compete with other women.
Right. So these studies show that essentially when you have women who feel like they're competing for the only spot at the top that's like a woman spot. So let's take the example of the law firm. Probably those female partners felt like, oh, well, there's only one or two female partners, so I have to be that one. So that means I have to like compete against all the other women. And that really kind of makes their mindset very zero sum and leads to them not maybe wanting to support younger women, because what if she comes and takes one of those woman slots? What if she comes and kind of usurps my place, you know, in the place where there's only room for one of us? So that's kind of how this all gets set up and why you start to see these kinds of actions.
So it's interesting. So it sounds like a lack of gender equality at the top is part of the problem here, because if there are more women present and women see ample opportunity for women to rise up, this behavior might not develop.
Yeah, and I think even more than that is sort of the need to make women not have to choose between being someone who is, you know, a good mother and a good, you know, or whatever roles they choose to have in their non-work time. So a good friend or a good, you know, whatever, sister, you know, not having to choose between their life and their work, having better work-life balance might also help with some of this, because then women don't feel like, oh, I have to, you know, I have to throw everything at this. I have to be so ruthless, because they realize that their company supports them in having sort of a balanced life.
Talking with Olga Kazan right now from The Atlantic about the question, why do women bully each other at work? And Olga, there's a theory, and you talked to the scientist who came up, who coined the phrase Queen Bee, about part of what's going on here. And she was reluctant to talk to you at first. She said it's kind of sad to hear these questions from you. But can you tell us about the Queen Bee theory and what it says?
Yeah, so that reluctant psychologist was Carol Tavris, but she coined this, or I guess most people think she coined this this term in the 70s in a Psychology Today article, and she calls it like the women who were against women's liberation back when that was really happening. But since then, I mean, people just really, you know, if you think about all the popular press that's been out there about this issue ever since, you know, people would really take this queen bee term and use it against any woman who has any strong opinions, basically. And so more recently, these researchers in the Netherlands have been looking at, you know, what makes women want to distance themselves from one another, to not want to collaborate, to sort of try to act more like a man or not like a quote-unquote typical woman. And they really find that it's a reaction to discrimination. So the queen bees are kind of reacting to something naturally within the workplace. It's not just that women are like this kind of themselves, or that they're like this psychologically.
Yeah, and it's interesting. You gave a quote from, I think it might have been Marissa Meyer from Google, but saying I'm not a woman in tech. I'm just another geek working in tech. So saying some distancing language that women can use to say, yeah, I'm not. Don't think of me as a woman, because they think it might be a disadvantage.
Right. So that's showing, you know, not a lot of solidarity with other women. And that is because they're like, well, if you see me as just another woman, women aren't doing so well here. So I want to look like just another geek, not just another woman, because that'll help my chances to really get ahead in this workplace. So that's sort of what that was trying to illustrate, because some of these academic terms can be a little hard to parse.
And before we get to callers, and there's a lot of them who want to talk to you already, Olga, but there's a really fascinating a series of studies done asking for teammates for Jeopardy, where the contestants, men and women, had to pick people to be on their teams. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so for the Jeopardy study, men and women had to essentially pick teammates for a round of Jeopardy on a computer, and they could choose among insecure and confident men and women. So it kind of behooved them to pick someone competent, because they stood to get a prize. So while the confident contestants of both men and women who were confident were seen as more capable, but the women were kind of torn between the insecure woman and the confident one. So they didn't necessarily act in their best interest, even when they could have, you know, stood to get a prize for doing so. And that kind of shows that women can sometimes be more biased against women, and that's something called the black sheep effect in psychology.
And tell us more, what is the black sheep effect?
Well, that's sort of where you see other people who are, so these women are behaving confidently, which is something that you're not used to women doing, or that's something that, you know, is not stereotypical of a woman. And so sometimes other women will look around and say, oh, you think you're so confident, you think you're so good, I'm gonna judge you really harshly for that. I really don't like that, even though you're also a woman, just because we can be a little bit harder on people from our own group when they break the rules than on people from another group.
Olga Kazan is with us right now from The Atlantic, talking about the question, why do women bully each other at work?
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Women, what has your experience been like at work? Have you seen this happen? Have you experienced this yourself? And in general, why do you think this can happen in some work environments? What would need to change? Call in at 800-642-1234. You can also post your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll continue our conversation and get to your questions, your thoughts, in just a minute on Central Time. We're picking up our discussion now about why women bully each other at work with Olga Kazan from The Atlantic.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you encountered this in your workplace? If you're a woman, do you see solidarity among women at work, or do you see this kind of competitiveness, maybe bullying or bullying or undercutting? Call in now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll take our first caller now. We've got Kelly joining us from Cascade. Hi, Kelly.
Hi. I have two things. One is a question, one's a comment. A question. I work in the healthcare industry, and I've worked in quite a few different arenas in healthcare, and I've always, with all but one time, I've had female bosses, and I really appreciated, I've appreciated each and every one of them, and I don't feel like I've experienced what you're talking about. So wondered if that is different for different industries. I think the one time I had a male supervisor, I felt he was a little less strong on the compassion side and understanding when that's a really important element of healthcare. The other part is I've experienced being a manager and a leader in different arenas in healthcare myself, and I feel like my leadership really changed after having children. Before I had children, I felt like I had to kind of prove myself, and some of that might have come along with just being a new to management and leadership. But after having children, I feel like the part of me that nurtures and tends to my children in a certain way has really come on board in my management and leadership. And so I feel like that's a real strength and brings a lot to the staff that I feel like I serve in a leadership capacity.
Kelly, thanks for that. And Kelly, let me ask you one quick question. Do you happen to be a nurse?
I'm not a nurse. I am an occupational therapist and currently a rehabilitation manager.
All right. Thank you, Kelly. Well, there's some studies about nurses, Olga, but to get at Kelly's bigger questions, you know, in healthcare, does occupation make a difference?
Yeah, so I don't know within healthcare specifically that there are studies on, you know, different types of specialists and whether or not they have what kinds of relationships they have with their managers. I would say in nursing, this is a huge problem. This is I heard from a lot of nurses, and they were really the ones who they started researching this kind of separately as just sort of a workplace bullying issue. So I don't know. I don't know if it's because nurses, they do sort of have that dynamic where it's usually a lot of female nurses, predominantly female nurses, and then often there will be like a male, doctor in charge or, you know, whoever runs the practice. So maybe that contributes to it, and maybe, you know, practices that don't have that dynamic don't kind of fall into this. But yeah, I really have no idea. I mean, I'm so glad that you have had really good experiences with female managers. This is, not suggesting that all female managers would create a bad experience.
And she said, Kelly said she felt ready to express her managerial side and confident in that after she had kids. Are there any sort of circumstances that help women express those parts of themselves?
Yeah, so this is like Lori Rudman and I got into this like girl talk kind of conversation toward the end where she's like, you should be more confident. So I don't know. I don't know if it's something that comes with sort of just age or getting more established in your workplace or even maybe the kind of field you're in. I mean, if you are in politics, you know, women who are in politics maybe have to express more kind of appeal to more voters or things like that. And so they might have to behave in a more kind of gentle way so that they can appeal to more people. But maybe women who work on a trading floor where everyone's like kind of brusque and not really all about the emotions, you know, maybe you don't need to kind of play up your femininity in that way. So I don't know. I guess it really just it's kind of individual, and it depends on your individual workplace.
Kelly, thanks a lot for that call. And we're going to go next to Elizabeth joining us in Neenah. Elizabeth, hi.
Hi. I called in as soon as I heard the topic, had to share because I've thought a lot about this from my own career. I actually started out in law, and I had three female partners. One was a judge, and all of them were, to be honest, really awful. And it was just a miserable experience working for all of them. And I used to think it was just because it was law. Because when I switched careers, I entered a completely different career. I've now had three female bosses, or maybe even four, and they've all been really wonderful to work for. And I used to just kind of chalk it up to law versus, in this case, higher education. But as I kind of looked at my bosses again, I also recognized that the bosses I had early on in my career really had entered the workplace and had entered management at a time when there weren't very many women in upper management. So I don't think they had a lot of mentoring and a lot of, I would say, female or male role models to draw from. Whereas my bosses that I've had in the last, I would say, decade or even two decades, really have had more opportunities, I think, for mentoring, to receive mentoring. And I think it's made a difference for them.
Really interesting, Elizabeth. Thanks for that. And Olga, something that struck me about what Elizabeth said was, it seems like if women themselves, as they're rising up through the ranks, if they're given the mentoring, as Elizabeth was saying, are treated well, are given a fair shot, they're going to treat others that way later on, maybe.
Yeah, I think that's definitely, I mean, that's definitely in line with what the research shows, which is that the women who don't feel like, I've given up so much to be here, so I'm going to make you give it up too, you know, are the ones, you know, the ones who will have been probably mentored, who will have been in a supportive work environment. And yeah, and that can be any kind of industry. You know, even if you work in kind of a tough industry, your bosses can still try to protect you or create a, you know, a better environment for you, no matter where you work.
Olga Kazan is with us right now. We're talking about a piece she wrote recently for The Atlantic called Why Do Women Bully Each Other at Work? We're going over some of the science that looks into this and hearing what you have to say. And right now we're going to go to Pam in West Alice. Pam, hi.
Hi. I'm hearing from some of the conversation earlier, I'm hearing what may have been a flaw in these studies. And that's it doesn't seem very objective about the way these women are being evaluated. And the example I'll give you is when your journalist was relaying some things that women had said about women managers, they rattled off something like, oh, they didn't have time to help their employees or some term like that because they were busy with their family. Well, you know, guess what? Just about every male manager I've had leaves you alone to do your job. You were hired for that job because you're competent at it, and they can't do all of the work they have. You're responsible for your own little piece of the universe, other than giving you guidance on what they want from you and occasionally helping you if you get stuck. They're not your best buddy. They're not there to pull up a chair and have a few beers. They're there basically to collect your work and report on it and, you know, give their manager status reports on how much is getting done and how far along they are. I've been a manager in IT, and I mean, I can give you an example of manager after manager. I'll give you an example of one at a major insurance company, one of the biggest ones in the country, who had his glass enclosed office. He's one of two project managers on our projects. And, you know, sometimes I'm the project manager, but that was a huge company, and so I had a more narrow role as a business analyst. But he would sit in his glass enclosed office all day and literally take conference call after conference call because he was the expert on a lot of things and he was the decision maker on a lot of things. He didn't have time to talk to employees. We rarely talked to him except for maybe one meeting every couple of weeks or so. And there was another project manager who came by every morning to talk to each one of us individually to see what was going on and how far along we were and whatnot.
I think I've got your point. Thank you, Pam. I really appreciate that call. I just want to make sure we have time for Olga to respond. Olga, what do you say to Pam's point?
Yeah, I mean, so regarding the studies, I mean, no study is perfect. I would say that one interesting thing about these is that they all kind of point to a similar pattern. So it would be things like the older, you know, female academics not finding the they thinking that the younger female academics were less dedicated to their work compared to the younger men academics, or saying that they, you know, don't identify strongly with other women, or saying they don't want to work with other women. So it's sort of you're right that not every study has the exact same question and answer. So there definitely needs to be replication of these studies, which is a problem in psychology kind of more broadly. But it is interesting that several of these studies and, you know, both in the Netherlands and in the U.S. and elsewhere kind of point to the same phenomenon happening. And as far as managers leaving you alone or kind of letting you do your work and not kind of being super touchy-feely, I think that's fair. I mean, these studies mostly evaluated whether older women had negative sentiments toward other women.
And we have to leave it there. Olga, thank you a lot. Thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
That was Olga Kazan, staff writer at The Atlantic. You can find a link to her piece called Why Do Women Bully Each Other at Work on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up tomorrow, Food Friday, influential musicians in Wisconsin, and more. That's coming up tomorrow on Central Time.